Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is security and system resiliency. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presentations given by Joe Engla of HNTB, Barbara Ivanov of the Washington State Department of Transportation, and Dave Hyden of Landstar. Joe Englot serves as HNTB's National Director of Infrastructure Security and oversees projects that reduce the vulnerability of bridges, tunnels, and transit facilities to malevolent acts, as well as projects that rehabilitate and retrofit structures against the effects of natural hazards and general structural deterioration. Joe has been project manager on Homeland Security projects for major public transportation agencies that specifically involve the assessment and protection of critical rail and highway transportation infrastructure. Prior to joining HNTB, he spent 33 years at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, where he had engineering oversight over several freight projects. Barbara Ivanov is the co-director of the Washington State Department of Transportation's Freight Systems Division. Her responsibilities include developing the state's strategic investment plan for the freight system and introducing the plan to community and regional leaders to gain regional participation and support. She is currently leading initiatives to improve freight system operational efficiencies, build a data framework to monitor system performance, and develop a resilient freight system. Dave Hyden is currently Director of Security and Cargo Loss Prevention for Landstar, which delivers safe, specialized transportation and logistics services to a broad range of customers worldwide. He has more than 20 years of experience in the transportation industry, is an active member of several organizations, including the American Society for Industrial Security and numerous cargo security councils. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. I'd like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next few weeks. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend the seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online, and I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are now eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you are attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. If you could type in your organization as well, that would be helpful. To obtain your credits, visit the AICP Certification Maintenance website after the seminar, log in using your ID and password, and select My CM Log, and then select Add Credits. I've also included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is security and system resiliency. Our first presentation will be given by Joe Englot of HNTB. As a reminder, if you have any questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and then we'll address them at the end of the seminar. So with Joe, you can begin.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. It's really a pleasure to be able to speak today. The presentation I'm giving is about a project that we being HNTB and Weidlinger Associates, who were part of our team. It's a project that we did for the New Jersey Department of Transportation and their Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And this first slide shows what the scope of the project was. They had previously looked at their inventory of over 6,000 bridges and prioritized it by an earlier method available through the the Federal Highway Administration. They wanted that prioritization to be updated to reflect the latest Homeland Security priorities, and to create a top 50 list of bridges and tunnels throughout the state in terms of criticality to the transportation system. They also wanted to make this multimodal and include rail, both passenger and freight, as well as the highway, bridges, and tunnels. And also, the first step would be to basically a prioritization and generate top 50 lists for all bridges and tunnels, and then for just the state-owned bridges and tunnels. Afterwards, we were going to go into the state-owned top 50 bridges and do a threat and vulnerability assessment of all of them and come up with general countermeasures and mitigation. So most of my presentation is focusing on the first part of this, which is the prioritization. Now, when in doing this, we keep in mind that our Homeland Security really, our focus nowadays in Homeland Security is on multi-hazard extreme events. It doesn't matter whether it's from an act of terrorism, whether it's an accident, or whether it's a natural hazard. That's why this approach is looking at it in that way as well. We look at, when we talk about extreme events, we're looking at mostly events that are not usually covered by the code, although seismic is. We're looking at collision, extreme winds, hydrocarbon fires from tanker trucks, terrorism, as well as other things like scour and flooding, which have caused a lot of bridge failures. And again, why do we focus on bridges? In a state, some states, depending on your climate, have different types of concerns. Everyone has bridges, and we know very well that those are the bottlenecks in your transportation system. And even though in this presentation we're looking at other vehicles like cars, we know that freight through trucks is always in competition with cars for detours and for looking at other ways to get across the state when there could be a lost bridge or let's say there could be a bad weather and a washout of a roadway. It's the same thing. Everybody's in competition for the same roadway, so that's why we're looking at everything. If we look over the last 40 years in the United States, across the states, there's been significant bridge collapses for many different reasons. We see here that sometimes scour or a barge collision could cause that. Other times it could be severe storms. And then we find bridges that fracture from other reasons, from stress corrosion could be anything, even the Minneapolis failure, which was supposedly from a design error. I mean, it doesn't really matter what happens, but this same prioritization holds is that it's really looking at the importance of any one of these top bridges and focusing on how that could be mitigated in one way or another. And we're also looking at rail, because here, I mean, there's been some notable rail bridge failures, and this is an example in 1993 where a bridge washed out in a storm at night and trains ran off of it, not knowing it wasn't there. So these are all really disasters, but that's what we have to look at. Homeland Security, right now, the focus is on preparedness for any type of disaster. Now, the previous screening methodology was based on this report, Guide to Highway Vulnerability Assessment, dated back to 2002. And the problem with that is that it looked at too many different attributes of the bridge, too many different reasons why the bridge might be important. And again, this is a reaction to 9/11. At that time, the focus wasn't on a systematic approach. The new approach we're looking at is really a systematic approach, looking at the movement of people and goods through the state. And so I've checked off here in red. Those were the attributes we're going to be focusing on in the new prioritization. The other ones can get a little bit confusing. We're looking at a highway or railway network. If we started looking at other things like communication lines and utilities, that would really be a different network we'd be looking at. And really what you ultimately have to do is look at all those networks, and there may be places where they overlap, but that would be for another effort, another study. The new screening criteria we looked at was really to align with Department of Homeland Security guidance, the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, look at the missions both of the State Transportation Agency and Homeland Security mission for transportation sector. And then resiliency really is a key. And in this analysis, that's what it's all about, because we're looking to see if we lose a bridge, what are the detours, possible detours for the movement of people and goods. And again, we're going to place a priority, if it's an evacuation route in the state, we're going to give extra priority to that, and we're going to look for a metric that where we can compare movement of people and goods in a multimodal way. And ultimately, the formula we developed really does show the economic impact. The larger the number, the bigger the economic impact on the region. These are assumptions we're making. We're saying that the failure of the bridge is hazard independent. It doesn't matter what hazard causes it. For that reason, we cannot look at casualties either in the first phase, because whether it's from a hurricane and the bridge is evacuated in advance and it fails, or whether it's from an act of terrorism where the bridge could be full of vehicles or people, we're not looking at that. We're assuming that it's a complete collapse of a span, and we're not really saying why. Well, it doesn't really matter, because it doesn't matter what kind of an event causes it. We're going to be looking at volume of people and goods. The system we have is going to be is basically using an Excel database, and we'll be able to rank all 6,000 bridges once we develop the formula. And the key items were, for highway bridges, we're very fortunate that we have this SINA database. The Federal Highway Administration has required that database be collected by every state. And we're going to be looking at these parameters, including maximum span length, that's critical, and other things like number of spans, number of lanes, to give us an idea of the size of the loss of the bridge, and then other information like where is the bridge located, and then, of course, detour length, which is part of the database, and then average daily traffic and average daily truck traffic. That's all data that's in the database. If you go on the Federal Highway website, you can find it for every single bridge in the country. Again, we're multimodal. We're looking at highway and rail. And then whatever formulas we come up with, we have to, in the end, perform a reality check to verify that there are redundant paths, and that what we're doing actually makes sense by examining some individual cases. Now, this is an excellent chart that we obtained. You're going to see the formulas we're using here are based on the formulas for delay that have been developed for highways, highway construction. There's many formulas have been developed for when you close a lane for highway construction, the impact of the delay, and it's usually expressed in so many dollars per delay of a passenger car, and then so many dollars per delay of a truck. And usually the truck dollars per hour of delay are about twice the car hours of delay. So we have a good ratio there, a truck's worth two cars. Now we, through this chart, which we went to a meeting of the short line railroads in New Jersey, we found out about that the Iowa DOT had this chart, which this helps us equate a truck and a rail car. One hopper car is equal to four trucks, and we use that in our formula as well. So then we apply these same delay equations that were developed for highway construction. And this is what we came up with. We made the transport unit an automobile, a passenger vehicle. And we know from those highway studies that an automobile has, on the average, 1.2 passengers. So that enabled us to equate it to a passenger on a railroad. So one railroad passenger is 0.83 transport units. And then a truck is two transport units. As I mentioned, it has about twice the impact of a delay of a 1 hour. And then the rail hopper car is equal to four trucks. So now all we have to do is determine the number of vehicles going over the bridge, which we get from the SINA database. The problem with that is, what we're going to see is that getting the rail data was a little more difficult. Now here's the formula we developed. We're actually going to measure in the top formula on the left side. That's the total delay of transport units in unit hours. That's the total time that bridge is not going to be in service. So if we take a bridge out of service, and we're going to say it's out of service for a period of time, we're going to count the total hours, unit hours of delay and what we're going to be doing is taking the total volume of transport units times the days of downtime that they're delayed, and then times the delay of due to the detour. You see, the fact that the bridge is out and they're going on another route, there's always a delay due to the detour. And we're using we use a lower speed for that, plus county congestion factors that we find in the state. But that's really the delay, is the fact that they have to use another route, and it's either extra mileage and extra time. And then we also put a factor on this, ER factors, which is about a 1.2. We give it a 20% boost if it's an evacuation route, so it ranks slightly higher. One of the most important parts of the formula is the downtime for loss of a bridge, and this is really a function of span length. And we've actually used case studies for this. Give you an example, if a bridge is 1,500 feet long, it would take 42 months to rebuild that bridge. And that's based on the latest, the newest Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which was a design-build contract. And we know that the schedule was as tight as could be and very efficient. And really, the fabrication, to refabricate a bridge and install it would take that amount of time for that span length. So we developed a formula that reflects that and other bridges. And that's a key to the screening criteria. Again, I mentioned the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, New Jersey, made every attempt to get information from the rail lines. And really, the people there that we talked to wanted to give us the information, but we think that the problem was, of course, if you're in a public agency, the law department says, why are you giving this information out? So we couldn't really get the same information that exists in the SINA database, so we had to find other ways of doing that. We went on, we resorted to looking in published information, and we were able to get a lot of information there, but it was very time consuming, so we could only focus on the most critical rail bridges and tunnels. Here's information that we did find. Of course, the FRA has extensive information on freight. Most states have freight-wide studies that show freight densities, like the map that's on the right, where we will see the amount of freight in megaton miles per mile, and we do have data on movements of on some critical freight lines of trains, and we found out that we were able to let me just go to the next slide. Some of the data we were able to get for New Jersey's, some of the most critical lines had 15 to 25 average daily trains. The average train length for the Northeast was 61 rail cars. And then we were able to we then looked at detours for some of the most critical bridges. The thing with rail is freight is that the detours are very long, whereas a detour for a highway bridge might be 5-6 miles. A detour for a rail bridge is usually much longer because there's many fewer of those intact lines where you could reroute traffic. Again, some of these had the longer spans, of course, were over rivers. So those are ones that you have to look at for more increased criticality. And if you have passenger trains and freight, then those really ranked even higher. And this is the results. When we screened the top 50 bridges in the state, and this is looking at all owners, first of all, we saw that the state-owned bridges were about 24% of those top 50. It's interesting to note, 70% were evacuation routes. And if we look at, because they rated high, they had to have either high average daily truck traffic, where we see 10,000 of them, exceeding 10,000 average daily trucks per day, 34% fell in that category. And then average daily traffic, now that's with trucks subtracted. In other words, in our formula, we counted them separately. So average daily traffic with trucks subtracted was, many had over 100,000 non-truck vehicles a day on the average, which is 38% in this top 50. So those we're seeing why they're getting into the top 50, because all these numbers in that formula for delay get you high numbers. And then this other item, I counted the number of bridges in the top 50 that would be out of service for one or more years, and that was one quarter of them. So these are long span bridges owned by most of them owned by authorities and other agencies that collect tolls and operate the longer bridges. And then again, we looked at passenger rail tunnels. 10% of these tunnels or bridges were passenger rail. They carry very high volumes of people when you compare them to highways, and then passenger rail bridges as well. So if you add those together, 18% of the 50 were either passenger rail tunnels or bridges. Now, if we look at freight rail, the top three freight rail bridges ranked 52, 110, and 145. So they're up there. When you think of all the bridges in that state, that's still in the top two percentile, those three bridges. So they are very critical as well. And then when we looked at just the state-owned bridges, we see that we compared the old screening criteria to the new screening criteria, and we found that 44% of the bridges now in the top 50 were not there before. And that's because of the criteria we put in. In fact, if we look at the third row here, no detour, there were actually four bridges in that top 50 that had no detours. They serve, as in many states on the coast, sometimes there are barrier islands that only have one bridge. And what this did is, because there's no detour, that delay number is bumped up much higher. It's actually set at 99 miles in the database. So those bridges, if they had a decent traffic volume and any decent span length, would move up to the top, which is true, because they are more critical. Again, high the same percentage of evacuation routes, similar percentages for high truck traffic and high passenger vehicle traffic. And if we in the state bridges, of course, they're shorter span lengths, but we saw that about one quarter of the 50 would have three or more months of downtime from if they were lost. That would be the time it would take to recover them. And that's very significant when you think of sometimes just being shut for several days, what it means. Being shut for 3 months on some of these critical bridges is very significant. Now, just to mention how we finished up on this, we took the top 50 state bridges, and we found that we could break from this database, the SINA database, we could actually break them into set, and we found only seven representative bridges. We were able to do those seven and then extrapolate it to the other 50, so we could actually come up with mitigations for all the bridges, the top threats and mitigations. And this is how it broke down. We found out that out of the top 50, 37 were multi-girder bridges, which were very similar. So we just looked at the longest one over water, the longest one over land. We did the same with the other systems. And by just doing these representative bridges, we were able to come up with the types of threats that would be damaging to them, that then good mitigations that would mitigate those threats, all in a risk-based a risk assessment for that. And to give you some examples of some of the top mitigations we found is, of course, when the bridge is on a waterway, fendering to provide standoff and protection for the piers, whether it's from collision or from explosives. Sometimes critical columns in an area that have to be jacketed to reinforce them. Things like closing and locking hatches and providing fencing on the lower right corner. You see fencing to prevent people from getting on the structure. So those are some of the mitigations we found. And this is a very interesting chart. What this shows is for the top 50 bridges. I'm just going to use the pointer here. What we have on this axis, this is the risk reduction that's calculated for each of these mitigations, and on the horizontal axis we have the cost of any given mitigation. And what we see is this upper left quadrant are the projects that have the highest risk reduction for the lowest cost. And we see here typically barriers and fencing were there, cameras and lighting, and this is probably from hydrocarbon fire. Intumescent paint, which could protect the steel bridge from a hydrocarbon fire, is up here too. So those are typically the kinds of mitigations that we found for those top 50 critical bridges, and certainly those would be the bridges that you would want to protect. So in summary, what do we have from this prioritization? The criticality, first of all, of every highway bridge in the state, all 6,000 are now ranked, and they can be sorted that way, and things can be prioritized for them that way. We could also use this as a tool for how we invest funds for security, but also state of good repair. All of these bridges should be kept in a state of good repair because they're critical, and be rehabilitated. This is a risk-based methodology. It qualifies for Homeland Security and TSA funding. If you're going to be looking at doing mitigations to these, and doing, let's say, emergency planning for rerouting, And it's a good tool also if you're looking to add new crossings. This would tell you where should you add those crossings. It'll tell you which ones are the most critical and which ones perhaps could use some redundancy. So this could also, as we know, we could do the detailed vulnerability assessment once we got through that phase. And really, it could be used to develop, once we had all the state bridges and we had all the mitigations, we could sort that in so many different ways by cost-benefit number and get any kind of a budget. If the state had any money at all, we know we'd be spending it on the most, for the best use of those funds to reduce risk for those top bridges. And that's the end of my presentation.
Well, thank you, Joe. And again, I do want to encourage anybody who has any questions for Joe to go ahead and type them in, and we will get to them in the last half hour or so of the seminar. We're now going to move on to Barbara Ivanov of the Washington State Department of Transportation. So, Barbara, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Jennifer, for the opportunity, and thank listeners for taking the time out of their busy schedules to think with us about how we can improve freight resiliency. Joe made a lot of great points. You're going to see that Washington State DOT is taking a bit of a different approach in several of the planning concepts as well as response concepts. And I think, again, it's a wonderful opportunity for discussion when we're comparing and contrasting how we want to approach these issues. So, can your state recover from major disruptions to freight systems? My presentation will cover three things. First, why resiliency of freight systems matters to a state, an MPO, or a local jurisdiction. Second, what are the 8 steps to a resilient freight plan? And third, what has WashDOT learned while we're trying to implement those steps? Turns out, again, there's been some twists and turns along that trail, and I would be delighted to share them with my colleagues.
Which is on average over 100
miles. First, why do freight disruptions matter? You just heard Joe talk about how they account for the economic loss due to a major closure of a bridge facility. We also have traditionally used a method that multiplies the number, the volume of trucks, times the hours of delay, times some amount that is a direct cost to the trucking company, and determined on either a national or regional average. But in the recent past, when we were faced with repeat floods of I-5, which is really the only there's no practical alternative to I-5 for truck freight on the West Coast. It's the only corridor. We do not have a redundant system here. We took a couple of steps further and interviewed and surveyed not only truck freight companies, but the shippers who run private fleets and freight-dependent industries. And what we learned was in just 2 short terms, each of these was about three or four day closure of the I-5 system and then of the I-90 that I'll refer to next. Our state lost almost $75 million due to those 2 singular events. What's interesting, when we did that work, actually asking companies how they were impacted, is we learned that about 40% of the direct impact was due to lost revenue. About 5%, small but significant amount, was due to the investment they needed to make in the future to prevent future loss. So the direct additional cost to trucking companies, it turns out, was, as you can see, about half of the total direct impact. That opened our minds up to understand, and the other thing that's important about this is that the economic loss affected freight-dependent industries in and across the state regions equally. There was a slight increase in the close proximate regional freight industries loss, but for the most part, whether you were in Spokane, Vancouver, or Seattle, the impact was very similar to the closure of the I-5 corridor. One of the things, again, that you can see on a map of Washington State is that here's the I-5 corridor. There's really no practical alternative route. There is one near detour here that can handle about 800 units total a day of anything, passenger and or truck, but the closure area here on I-5 typically handles over 10,000 trucks, just trucks per day. So you can see that 90% of these trucks are going to have to go somewhere else than use of this detour, and the next detour is hundreds of miles around. And I think when we get to Dave's presentation on Landstar, it'd be interesting to hear about what he thinks that means to hours of service and all the other dilemmas that happen when truck drivers get stranded on a long detour. So what happened in the I-90 closure in Washington State? We have mountain passes that run through the middle of the state. They really separate the west side from the east side of our state, and we have certainly as we approach this storm season and storm seasons in the past due to avalanche danger, the need to close those mountain passes. And in the incident in 2008, it was closed for almost 4 days with no opportunity for trucks to pass. Again, if you close the mountain passes, as we had to, you can see what happens. The I-90, which is our primary truck freight corridor east-west, was closed. There was no alternate detour except for a long drive around the Oregon side down here on 84, and at one point, 84 had to close because of ice. So again, what was the freight-related economic impact? And I want to make sure I'm being very clear. This is does not account for the damage to the local community, damage to the local infrastructure. Those are accounted for separately. This is the $75 million due to two highway closures only accounts for the freight-related, the impact on trucking companies and freight-dependent industries throughout our state. So, it matters because it hits our state's economy. How can we develop resilient freight systems? And again, I'm going to focus my talk on developing resiliency and really leave the experts like Joe and Dave to talk about preparation and response. Resiliency is defined as the ability to rapidly restore service after a disruption. And we had the privilege of working with the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics on developing a plan that any state could use. I actually asked them to please make sure that it was a plan that sort of a reasonably intelligent person could use, not just an MIT grad, so that we could take this plan, this logical structure, look at the action items it contained, and work on them step by step. And that's indeed what they produced. The 8 steps in this plan that a state, an MPO, a local jurisdiction could use. Number one is, you have to know who your customers are. It's not enough to understand or to map the transportation facilities. You need to know how your supply chains operate on those facilities in order to protect your state's economy. And in our state, we have three meta supply chains, Global Gateways, Made in Washington, delivering goods to you. I'll come back to that shortly. You then work with those customer groups to understand what the goals are for recovery. I mean, it'd be great to recover within 10 minutes 100% of the facility, right? But that could be awfully expensive. That could imply you've got a spare freeway sitting on the side ready to be opened up. Again, there's a risk-cost analysis that we all want to go through. So we're I'm giving you just top-of-mind examples here. These are not our state's goals, but for a global gateway system where you've got a, as Washington State does, port operations that serve the entire nation through a port rail land bridge system, returning container flow to some set level within some number of days of the event would be a goal that would meet their needs. Again, the goals are set by those customers. Delivering goods, that's how we get our food, how we get our water, how we get our healthcare supplies, our fuel. So restoring truck access on an urban corridor to some level within some amount of time period, again, is set up based on your own risk-reward analysis. The third step is to analyze the vulnerabilities. And I think Joe, again, presented some really interesting information about how to go about doing that. We suggest that you also need to consider not only the infrastructure, but the vulnerability of different customer segments. How private firms use it, your transportation infrastructure, and where their vulnerabilities lie. The fourth step, engage your private sector partners. Build the relationships and develop a communication plan designed for their needs with them. And the center of the communication plan is the freight notification process. Fifth step, you must decide what policy and regulations have to be in place long before a disruption occurs. We continue to work on that in our state. Sixth step, decide how you're going to set priorities, again, before the event happens. So in the example I used with I-5, we had one near detour. Again, only 10% of the trucks would be able to use it if that detour was even available. So who gets on? Is it the guy who's got the governor's, you know, home phone number? Is it the really loud guy or the most important? How do you decide that? Whatever your situation is, when you have lost capacity, who gets to use what is left and available? Number seven, running failure analysis simulations. Again, that helps us do our long-run planning to understand where that critical infrastructure lies and to what types of industries, freight-dependent industries, are there high vulnerabilities. And last, of course, you test and prove the plan by running exercises on it. So let's dig a bit into those steps. Step one, again, we identified these three big meta categories. Global gateways means manufactured goods primarily entering our West Coast port system, land bridging across by rail. This is oil coming down from Alaska. Made in Washington. In our freight system, we are proud to be a global gateway, but we also care about our eastern side of the state's agribusiness sector, our western side's timber sector, our manufacturing centers along the I-5 corridor and in the urban areas. And we care a lot about whether or not our consumers are able to get the goods they need to make it through their day. What do they need? When we worked with MIT, and I really want to emphasize this, we were present in all of the interviews with our state freight customers. We really make a purposeful direction to gain customer intelligence by working with them in their place of business, going to wherever it's convenient for them to understand their continuity plan, how they need government to act, and letting them set the goals. So when we did that with our colleagues at MIT, we learned that they have no idea who in government to call after an event happens. They rely on the media because there's no freight-specific information, or there was none at that time, for them. There was no communication system in place allowing any government agency to communicate directly with them, and they value accurate, timely information above all else. One of the planning tools that we are developing, I think is, again, an interesting way to compare and contrast what we're doing, is a supply chain-based model of our state's freight systems. And our University of Washington and Washington State University colleagues have developed our state's first GIS-based multimodal freight model this year. This model is going to allow us to see how those freight-dependent industries would reroute goods if there is a closure of or a severe capacity restriction of our primary freight highway corridors. It gives us a chance, again, to look at the different supply chains and learn which of the supply chains our industries are most vulnerable to which particular closures on which corridors. And we illustrate that with two case studies. We worked on one in agribusiness, because that's very important to, again, the eastern side of our state, and diesel fuel distribution, because that's a fundamental need in our delivery system. What our university colleagues' model was able to show for the potato system is potato growing area and processing area is concentrated here in the eastern part of the state. There's some growing areas here in northwest Washington as well, but if you close the mountain passes, remember this is not an imaginary event, it's something that frequently happens in our state. The typical east-west routes are all closed from the processing growing area to the big consumer market, where they will divert. That's a very different pattern of diversion from the diesel fuel distribution. So in this case, again, this is your typical diesel fuel distribution pattern in Washington State. Fuel, remember our earlier chart, the crude oil is coming down from Alaska. It's being refined here in northwest Washington. It ships around the coast either by tanker barge or inland or here by pipeline. And then it's sent out from the terminal racks by truck to the final leg of its distribution. So you can see how those terminal rack distribution patterns look as a normal pattern in our state. However, if that mountain pass or group of mountain passes is closed, you can see how the distribution pattern changes and reaches out from each of these terminal racks to a greater distance to cover, again, the same territory. So those different supply chains, I think, really interesting set of case studies, because it shows how, in addition to just looking at volume on these facilities, we need to understand how our freight-dependent sectors use those facilities. We know from this work that the potato agribusiness traffic pattern is very, very dependent on east-west truck trips on I-90 between the growers and the market, but their margin, their profit margin per truckload is so low during a disruption, they're not going to drive around. They're going to sit and wait it out if they can. What does that mean? You could postulate for their ability to be a reliable provider of product for their customers. On the other hand, diesel delivery from terminals to fuel stations, resiliency is really built into that system because the diesel truck marketers are all the time shopping price and will drive actually pretty long distances from rack to rack if they can get a lower price to sell in the market. And so again, not dependent at all on I-90, much more resilient than the potato system for those reasons to disruption of the I-90 corridor. Okay, I'm going to come back to away from that planning tool for a minute and talk about two very high-value, low-cost, practical operational steps that we're taking to improve our resiliency. This freight notification system has three essential elements. Number one is internally, we have to have situational awareness. We have to know and be able to communicate internally about the information that is picked up by a maintenance supervisor in a region out in the field, send that to the freight central communications system, set up a robust distribution service, and I want to emphasize there's a lot of commercial companies that provide this at pretty low cost nowadays, and maintain a freight customer database so that you can distribute that in real time. The highest value of this system is our ability to provide predictive information so they can plan ahead. In the case of the I-5 closure that I referenced earlier, we were able to tell them we're about to close I-5. There's a very high probability it will close at 4 p.m. today, start moving your staff, equipment, and inventory to be ready for that. Here's an example of one of the types of notices we'd send out. And I want to also explain another very high-value operational service that we are developing currently with our state emergency management division, that's part of our military department, and the state patrol. We are developing a new commercial vehicle pass system to safely and efficiently authorize emergency, essential, and other goods delivery to and through affected areas during a highway disruption of 2 to 7 days duration. We have pre-authorized at a policy level. Our state has said there are three goods categories, and here's their definition. Category A emergency is set by the state EMD. It depends on the event, so if we've got a volcano, it might be air filters. If there is a flood, it could be generators. If it's an earthquake, maybe it's canvas tents. They set that up actually during the event, and the system is flexible enough to immediately incorporate that. Category B, essential goods. You can read the list. These are the things that keep the communities functioning during and immediately after, and support recovery. Category C is everything else as detour capacity allows. We'll be implementing this online pass system the first quarter in early January of 2010, and trucking companies and shippers will be able to actually print out a pass at their location. It's date and time stamped, and it will allow them to be waved through the checkpoints on a highway detour, depending upon, again, what priority of goods they're carrying. So what have we learned in all of this? Number one, response does not equal recovery. The skills, the objectives, the resource needs are quite different. So my takeaway is, if you're sitting down in the incident command with fire chiefs, county sheriffs, maybe the FBI, police folks, you're going to have to bring a strong negotiating position there to help them understand what will facilitate economic recovery and delivery of those emergency and essential goods through the system. Number two, both the public and private sectors have got to jointly own this. That means they both have to be part of developing it. They both need to understand what their roles are in the recovery plan and how to communicate throughout. We've got to have a reliable, credible, user-friendly freight notification system so that the shippers and truck carriers have not only real-time road conditions but predictive information so they can plan. Pre-planning mechanisms to fast-track recovery, and again, last, be able to manage freight lane scarcity, and our approach is the new commercial vehicle pass system. Any more information, we've got some reports online we'd be happy to share with you. Again, I want to thank you for your time and be happy to take any questions at the close of this session.
Well, thank you, Barbara. And I do want to let everybody know that the development of the statewide freight system resiliency plan is actually available for download in the file share box, in addition to being able to get it from the website. We'll now move on to our final presentation given by Dave Hyden of Landstar. And Dave, I'll bring your presentation up and you can begin.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Taking the time to listen to the seminar or the WebEx here. I'm going to talk about the 10 plus 2 programs, the CBP programs, Customs Border Protection, which is, I think, a very good program. It's created a lot of work for companies or extra work. And I'll touch base on that, and then I'll touch base on the TWIC, and then the TWIC card, and then about disaster relief that would go along with that. I'm going to put a scenario together, sort of like a disaster happening, like at the Port of LA, and the economic causes that the economic cause that would create. The security filing, CBP's come out with some new requirements for importing goods into the United States before it gets into a container. This is sort of more the legal side of it. It's all electronic. And for a forwarder, when you're stuffing the container, these 10 elements are things that are required now before the good is put into the container, and it's required that you let customs know 24 hours in advance of what's going into that. You have to let them know 24 hours in advance before it's stuffed in there, and then they could still reject that coming into being loaded onto a ship. But these extra steps do, they have caused extra man hours. You might be moving something from China that's manufactured in China, but you would also have to know where the goods originated from, where they were actually, the raw materials came from. So even though you're moving freight for a customer out of China, and the freight comes, the raw goods come out of Bangladesh, you need to know where and who the customer was in Bangladesh to get that information. So it can be quite time-consuming alone to get that information, and it can just delay. If you can't get the information, you're not going to get the stuff put into the container and get it moving to the United States. So there is a lot of extra work and man hours that go along with that, and then obviously some customers' freight will be delayed for shipment to get on that. My slides got out of order there. The effective date on this was last year, January 26, 09, and it's been a soft enforcement through January 26 of 2010. All indications are it's going to go it's going to be active on January 26, 2010. There's no information coming down saying that it's still going to be a soft enforcement. So that is a system that will be live and continue forward. I think it's obviously something that's worked well. We haven't had any problems with the ports and any goods coming into the port, so I think all the extra effort that's needed from the forwarders to get that information to customs and before it's loaded on a ship is obviously is working out well for our own homeland security. Quick transportation workers identification credential. Anyone who's working on a pier or anyone delivering goods onto a port needs to have this card. And there was quite a backlog for these, and it was like a 4 to 6 week wait for anyone to get one, and it required a fingerprinting. It also required a federal background check in order to be cleared for this. If one of our drivers had a hazmat endorsement on his license, he was halfway there. He already had the federal background check done, but he still needed a good process to do the fingerprinting. And for drivers, they look at it as it's just an additional cost to pick up the same freight. Some trucking companies look at it. In Landstar's case, we require the driver, if he wants to pick up freight from the port and have that availability of that freight, then he has to pick up that cost. I know that some other trucking companies actually pick up the cost themselves. So at a cost of $132.50 per driver, and it's a card that's good for 5 years, it can be quite expensive for the trucking company or for the individual. There's a lesser cost of $105 if you already have your hazmat endorsement, but then you might not get the full term of the 5 year availability of the TWIC card. About 35% of our drivers have TWIC cards. When I went online last week and looked at the enrollment, a little over 1.4 million people have enrolled into the TWIC program, and almost 1.3 million have actually picked up the card and completed the process. The TWIC card is a biometric card, and the port should have a reader there to confirm the authenticity of the card. All drivers that are picking up or delivering to a port have to have a card. The co-driver has to have a card. Some ports are actually not letting passengers into the port, even if they would have a TWIC card. Anyone can get a TWIC card. So there's been some confusion there of who's letting on. And then also another layer that trucking companies have to face is some ports have another card that you have to have just for access into certain parts of the port. So the TWIC card basically says, yes, you've got a federal background check and you're a good person overall, but then the port might require another $40, $50, $80 their own port card for the driver, so they know what access that he has throughout the port. So there's other expenses, and every port can have their own card. So
one driver who delivers over the road to several ports might have up to a dozen different cards, might have one for Miami, might have one for New York, New Jersey, might have one for Long Beach. So it can get quite expensive when once you start adding it all up for the driver. And again, they a lot of drivers will look at it as, well, it's just an extra cost of doing business that I used to, that I didn't need, and some of them won't take freight that picks up or delivers at a port anymore. So, and some trucking companies got away from it. It's just an extra layer of security that I think is needed for the homeland, for the protection of our homeland. What would happen if the port shut down? It was hard for me to find information on the actual shutdown of the ports back at 9/11, but I can equate that when the longshoremen in Los Angeles were on strike for 9 days, they estimated that loss of revenue was $1 to $2 billion a day for the 9 days that the strike was going on. So the impact of all the ports being shut down for a series of days after, if there was a catastrophic event, I could only imagine being $6-7 billion roughly. It's hard to say what that would actually equate if all the ports were to ever have to shut down. Local drayage companies absolutely have no work. Their whole line of work is just to move containers off the port to a rail yard or a pickup yard or an over-the-road truck driver. And then if you look at Los Angeles as a disaster, the area of a disaster, if a bomb went off over there or something like that, you would have an influx of equipment. Any trucking company would as well. You would have freight that's destined for there, maybe not for the port or even another customer that can't get empty, and then you have that flow of trucks still coming in trying to with those goods, and then you also have the trucks coming in with disaster relief. Like Barbara talked, we've handled a lot of hurricane relief with FEMA and the FAA, and you have that constant flow of goods coming in, whether it's water, food, generators, in the hurricane situations, tree grinders. There's just so much freight coming in, and just because it's ordered doesn't mean that's going to get empty. That equipment will be empty right away either. And then also, there's just so much more that goes on with moving the trucks around. Are there detours? Are there bridges out? What's the fuel availability? Are the trucks going to be able to keep fuel in the tanks? So there's quite a bit that goes on when you are doing disaster relief. Every day, there's, as the slide shows, there's quite a few trucks and rail cars. The amount of business every day that's touched by our port system or our infrastructure is just incredible to think that we have 30,000 trucks, 6,500 rail cars every day that are just going just on the normal business day of freight. And then, the stock market would also be a major problem as well for the whole country. Also, as you're moving freight into an area, again, like at Los Angeles, if that was the area that there was a problem, it gets very costly to move freight in there. As you get the new freight demands from whatever emergency responses, whether it would be from the state of California giving you direction for new freight, and they're ordering 50 trucks of water and numerous trucks of generators, the cost to deliver those goods go up too, because everyone knows that you can't get freight out of there anymore because of the disruption of the economic flow of freight. So the rates will increase just to get a load covered to go into the disaster relief area. That's really about all I had to talk about here. I know it's a brief description of the flow of goods and everything, but I can tell you that Landstar does feel that the new CBP requirements, whether it's the 10+2 and or the TWIC card, are certainly needed to protect this country and keep the flow of goods moving at all times. I didn't touch base too much on the plus two. The plus two are the ship's responsibilities. They have to report where the container is on the ship, and they have to also notify customs 48 hours or 24 hours also before they reach port as well of their goods and such. That's all I have to talk about that. I'll turn this back over.